Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
This is Graham McTavish, and you are listening to Ginger and Summer on the Outlander podcast.
Welcome to episode 103 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer. And we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. It was announced that Frances de la Tour has been cast as Mother Hildegard. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people post her as their, like
fan casting, yeah.
Fan casted her. Personally, I had Maggie Smith, but
yeah,
I do think this was a good choice. So I am satisfied with this casting.
She looks pretty. She's pretty perfect.
She is, absolutely. Loved her in Harry Potter. I plan to love her in Outlander. We also got a couple of behind the scenes shots from the Outlander Instagram account. We got a shot of Murtaugh. Most of his face is obscured by the clapper. So Murtaugh is obscured. However, you can see Claire quite clearly drinking, as she is wont to do.
Maybe,
perhaps behind the scenes. I think this is episode probably 115.
Yeah, it says 15 right there.
I wasn't even looking at that. So yeah, episode 115.
I was just cheating. I'm just that good. I just read what's
all
given.
Of the above. She is that good, and she does cheat.
And I do read.
And she reads.
I'm legitimate.
You're a legitimate reading cheater?
No, what do you call
it? I don't know.
Literate.
You just figured that out?
I'm legitimately literate.
She's been literate for a while.
Since I was like 4 months old. No, I'm just kidding.
That's not true. She did start blowing her nose at like 6 months, apparently.
No, like 6 weeks.
Okay. We also got a behind-the-scenes shot from one of the early episodes in season one of Katrina Balf lounging in a chair. What I remember of her lounging in this chair is that she very quickly is kissed by Tobias Menzies.
Mm.
It's right before he heads off, isn't it? Or is it? Oh, no, that's not true, because she's not wearing the same outfit. This looks like the outfit she wore when she was at the Reverend's house.
I think so.
But that chair shot makes me think of the scene right before she goes to the
stones.
She's
lounging and reading.
Yeah. But she's on a totally different outfit.
Same dress. I mean, same shoes, though.
No? She probably... I mean, in her defense, I wear almost the same pair of shoes every day.
Oh. There's nothing to defend. I just think it's the same pair, but I could be wrong.
We also got a couple of new shots of Season 2 this week. Entertainment Weekly posted some Season 2 shots. We have one of Sam Heughan looking very French, and honestly,
this
is...
But what's the biggest deal about this? It's the first official shots from...
Season 2.
Well, from Season 2, obviously.
The only thing I'm going to say about this shot is that the lighting downplays the redness of his hair. So he looks more like...
A dark blonde or a light brunette.
Right. Pre-Outlander Sam Heughan.
Mm-hmm.
Like his dark blonde hair that if you look at his old promotional shots, this is the color that it looks
but
like.
But I can't wait. I mean, you see a little hint of it here, but I can't wait to see. Because this is where, from now until... Who knows how many books we'll get to screen. But from now till the... except for maybe part of something, maybe. Can't say what it is. But pretty much, our Jamie from here till the end of time has longer hair.
He does, but he's not this clean shaven.
No, not typically, but I'm saying the hair, I'm so excited to see it back and then down and then plaited. Woo!
I agree. The only thing I'm going to say about this is that every shot that we've seen so far that's been unofficial from season two, I've been like, he's clean shaven, it's okay. And the last time I saw him, and by I mean all of us, saw him in season one, he was a little scruff, and I thought that was totally hot and sexy. And all of the behind-the-scenes shots of him shaven, I've been kind of like, okay, I'm glad, he looks okay. It's still Sam Heughan, he's still an attractive gentleman, but not nearly as hot as the stubbly Sam Heughan that we've seen from the previous season. However, this shot with him clean shaven with that hair, I take it all back. He's super hot like that. I will take him shaven.
You were thinking only Scruffy Jamie.
I thought that was maybe the only thing I liked, but I take it back. He's looking pretty good.
And the shot, let's not forget, we started with season two and then talked about Jamie first, but the set design that we have seen, just the snippets from the background, brilliant.
I mean, but did you expect anything less?
No, of course not. John Gary Steele is a genius. And, of course, Katrina Balfe, her Terry Dresbach and her team. Stupendous work. And those dresses.
Hand-painted. Oh, hand-painted. They look amazing. The only thing I would like to say is that even though you may not be listening to this today as we're recording, but it is July 5th. It is Ron D. Moore's birthday. So happy birthday, Ron Moore.
Yay. Without whom. And thank you for his parents. Because without...
Thank you for his parents.
We're thankful to his parents for having him. Because...
Well, then thank you to his great-grandparents and his great-great-great-grandparents. Talk about time travel. I mean, if you want to go back. Thank you to all of the history that had to happen to make today.
For Ron Moore to be without Outlander. Yeah, absolutely. Very exciting. And then one more.
I mean, I know all of you know this, but just in case some of you have been under a rock, Outlander is going to be at Comic-Con next week. Outlander Pod will also be at Comic-Con next week. They will be having a panel Saturday, July 11th at 4 p.m. 4 p.m. to 4:45 p.m. in Ballroom 20. So if you are at Comic-Con and you just don't know where Outlander is going to be, Ballroom 20, Saturday, July 11th, 4 o'clock to 4:45. Featured at the panel, we will have Sam Heughan, Ron D. Moore, Katrina Balfe, Meryl Davis, and Diana Gabaldon. And there will also be an autograph session Saturday, July 11th from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the Random House booth, and that's number 1515. But the thing to know is that we'll be there. So if you're interested in anything Outlander, I promise you we've made that first and foremost on our plot of things we need to do for the time that we're there. So if there's an Outlander event happening, we're going to be there. So pay attention to our Twitter. We will be tweeting, live tweeting pictures as much as we can. So be sure to follow that. Hashtag to come soon. And that's announcements. So I haven't said this for a while, but now it's time for our read-along.
This week we are discussing chapter 20 entitled La Dame Blanche.
Claire starts the chapter off with the question of the day. Who is La Dame Blanche? A servant, Magnus, lends a hand. La Dame Blanche is une sorcière, also called the White Lady, a wise woman, a healer.
So technically we're both La Dame Blanche, because we both white ladies.
How are we both white ladies?
You're not a white lady? I'm a lady. I'm white.
You mean because we're pale freaks?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Pasty. Translucent.
LNG writes, Claire is pretty loose with her language and in front of the help, in quotes. But then, how much English do they really know?
I guarantee they know more English than I know French.
So people are afraid of, or perhaps have a healthy respect for, La Dame. She asks Jamie if he'd known of her, and he hems and haws, but says yes. She tells him that the men who had attacked her had called her such, and then ran off, quote, as though they just noticed I had plague. So, Jamie's been keeping something from his wifey. He reveals that he'd told Glengarry, that she was La Dame Blanche. Actually, him and Castellotti. They'd thought it funny that Jamie was faithful to his wife, so he finally said that she was La Dame Blanche, so they'd quit jibing at him. Something along the lines of, if he tried any funny business, she'd shrivel his private parts.
But for real, how is that the first thing you, like...
think of to say?
You think of, you're like, how do I tell these people that I love my wife and I don't want to have, you know, relations with somebody else?
She's a white lady.
I can't just say that I love my wife and I don't want to have relations with somebody else. Apparently, I have to make up a story about her being some crazy sorceress lady who will shrivel my manhood.
And what's funny is that they believed him. Or what is great is
I think that's par for the course for the time period. I mean, people were very superstitious back then because they didn't understand, you know, the things around them the way we do now.
But Jamie says he had waited till the fourth bottle to tell them. Bottle of wine. That was very considerate of him. Or he just wanted to make sure he had made the ground ripe for the
it'll make ground ripe to you.
I mean, it depends.
Made the field ready for it. So the drunker they were, the more likely that they would believe him. He says, it was the best I could think of. And they did stop pushing trollops into my arms. Since it wasn't Glengarry or Castellotti, they'd been with Jamie at home when Fergus came to get him, one or both of them must have spread the word. You know, played the game telephone.
Well, I mean, I think it's been made very clear from the previous chapters that the biggest thing, the biggest source of entertainment for this time period is gossip. So if you have some juicy gossip, and that's some juicy gossip, for somebody to say, oh, my wife's a white lady and she'll shrivel my manhood if I even look at another woman.
Or as the French would say, that's some gossip juicy.
I'm assuming that's some riff on how they build sentences in France. Yes. That means nothing to me, so we'll move on.
Ellen G. writes, help her heal. Oh, sorry.
Is that what she wrote? Far to myself. I don't think that's what she wrote.
She did write it, but we're not there yet. Ellen writes, Jamie is being quiet here, drinking his hot chocolate, and when he learns that the men who attacked Claire called her that, he gets really perturbed. He told the men he was with at the brothel that Claire was la dame blanche to keep them from sending women his way. In trying to help Claire and keep her safe, he has unknowingly focused down the pool of attackers to search out.
However, he didn't do that to keep her safe.
He did it to keep his modesty.
Right.
Or his chastity.
It was completely unintended. However, it worked in multiple fashions. So it was a lucky thing that he happened to just come up with. I mean, Diana was brilliant in deciding that that's what happened. That's not why he did it, but it affected.
And without giving, and this is not a spoiler, it's just an interesting tidbit.
Is it?
The whole subject matter of Claire as the white lady is something that does not go away.
I mean, it follows her. It follows her. It's followed her. It started in the first book.
They just didn't. Pale. Yes.
Not even that. I mean, it's not just that she's pale. It's what it signifies. I think what's more important is what it signifies, because a lot of people are pale. Especially probably in that time period, especially the aristocrats, because they were, you know, it was prized to have pale skin because you didn't work. You weren't out in the sun, and that's something that signified you as being part of the upper class.
Jamie has errands to do. He needs to go see Glengarry to find out whom all he had told. And then to see Charles to see what was up with the arrangement with the Comte Saint-Germain. And Claire goes to see Master Raymond and then Mary Hawkins. When discussing herbs, Claire says regarding lavender, which is a soothing aroma, that it depends on whose nerves are involved, whether it's soothing or not. This is because, of course, Jamie is anything but soothed by its scent. She says regarding Mary Hawkins, in this case, though, it might help. Do no harm, at any rate.
Does anybody, purposefully not go near lavender on Jamie's behalf? Do you think about that? You're like, oh, that's got a lot of lavender in it.
Oh, wait, I'm not going to buy that. You mean
fans? Yeah, anybody.
I thought you meant in the books. I'm like, well, Claire.
No, not in the books. I mean,
in real life?
In real life.
I'm sorry. Okay, he is fictional. I love Jamie.
I get that he's fictional.
But, dude, I love me some lavender. That's all I'm going to say.
I like lavender in moderation. I think that honestly, most medicinal herbs and or herbs in general in excess are too much. For instance,
anything is.
From time to time, your oregano oil is cloying in too much for me. I can't. It's overpowering.
But I rarely use it outside of, I'm not going to say
okay.
it. Okay, I put oregano oil, therapeutic grade oregano oil that has been wholly distilled and not, it has all of its constituent parts. It is not, all of the constituent parts that were originally part of the herb are still, you know, we're distilled together. Nothing was siphoned off except the hydrosol. I know a little bit about
essential oils.
Distilling. You know, I've taken organic chemistry.
Distillation.
Distillation. Yeah, I've done some distillation, and we did distill some, or attempted to distill a little bit of cinnamon oil from cinnamon, or
like a stick.
Yeah, you start with it and you grind it up and you go through the whole process. It was really fascinating. I know a little bit about it, not a lot, but enough to get myself in trouble by probably stepping all over the right things and getting a lot wrong. But anyway, when you distill an herb or a flower or a plant and to get the oil, you're also left with this water that has some of the essence, I won't say properties, that's a little woo-woo, but has the essence, and it may have some of the smell, but has the essence. You'll get the oil and you'll get a water product. And the water product is called a hydrosol. And so while I wonder, I would guess that there's also something called oregano hydrosol. So I definitely don't use oregano hydrosol. I do use oregano essential oil, but I put it on the soles of my feet. The feet have the largest pores in the body, and oregano is a known natural
pizza ingredient.
It does smell like pizza, but oregano is a known natural anti a lot of things, and so I don't do it every night like I believe, like I would like to. But what Summer is talking about is the smell, the eau de that she smells,
that permeates the living
areas.
Yeah,
when I use it. So yeah. Anyway, so that's what she's talking about.
But I will say that there's a lot of things that you can do with back onto the lavender. There's a lot of things that you can do with lavender oil, which make me a little sad because every time I use it, I feel a little bad about it. But for instance, mosquito bites. Lavender oil is amazing for mosquito bites. Like if I get a mosquito bite and right away put lavender oil on it, it doesn't itch. It doesn't start itching later. It just, for whatever it does, it sucks the itch away and it never itches. It's like almost the only thing that's ever worked for mosquito bites because I'm like highly allergic to mosquito bites. So I end up with like giant welts all over my body. Not all over, but where the bite is. But it's no fun. But lavender oil. Did you ever do those little like cross marks in like when you had like a mosquito bite? Like when you just like, I don't know where I heard about
with
it,
your
but
nails?
Like, yeah, like you like dig into it, like make a little cross mark in it.
What? For what purpose?
To make it stop itching.
Oh, well, that's not... Okay, it has nothing to do with the cross mark. It has to do with applying pressure or... Not pain, but basically a lot of pressure. Whether it's... It's the same idea, I believe, as say you have... Have you heard of people who have, like an itchy part of their face or an itchy scalp? They'll kind of slap at it?
I have heard that, and I can't go further into it.
But it's the same idea, whether you're taking your nails into something to like, counteract...
But the reason you slap it instead of scratch it is because you don't want to break the skin. No, you don't want to break the skin. You just want to agitate it so it doesn't hurt anymore.
Well, I wouldn't do anything hard enough to my scalp to break the skin.
No, but you wouldn't even do it on purpose. But if, like, a lot of people who have, like, relaxers or they do perms and stuff in their hair, if they pat it... Yeah. It affects it, like, you know, breaks up whatever's going on. But if you scratch it, you stand a chance of accidentally, like, breaking that layer of skin.
Or messing up your hair. I mean, there's two different things. But, yeah, I've taken not a brush, because that's too massive and that would whack me one good. But, like, a thin comb or something. Even a ruler, if it's around. And I'll just, like, kind of whack myself on the head a little bit. Or probably use my hand, because that's what I've always got with me. And
you always have your hand with you?
Pretty much. And just kind of thwap, thwap, thwap on my skull.
Is that a technical term?
Yes. And I just said it was. Or I just made it one. And
I want you to know, if you go back and Google thwap, thwap, you might find something a little bit different. But we're going to go back. Move on.
And we're going to pretend. So anyway, it's not, I don't think it necessarily takes away the source of the itch or the itch itself.
But
what
it does is distracts, like it messes with the nerve endings or what?
You are adding another sensation to it. And even though I don't think anyone wants to cause themselves pain,
is highly distracting from itching.
No, it's very distracting, but we're not talking like giving yourself a black eye or anything or cutting yourself. But if you make like a smart slap, it really doesn't hurt.
Smart slap.
It really doesn't hurt, but you're making enough of an impact and like you said earlier, enough of a difference in sensation.
Okay.
That it does help take your mind off of it, or truly stop that sensation.
I'll take it.
So in this case, though, she says, it might help. Do no harm at any rate. This is the first part of the Hippocratic Oath, she points out, which physicians swear. When Raymond asks her if she'd sworn it, she replies, well, no, not actually. I'm not a real physician. Not yet.
Foreshadowing.
Hello.
And that's then a lot of singing she for says, like 2 second period of time.
Over both
should,
of us?
We should stagger it and only have one of us singing at a time.
Hey, it's whatever happens, happens.
Saying,
it's natural.
It's a little weird.
And then the line that directly follows that end quote is, I couldn't have said what made me add this last sentence.
I could.
Yeah, that's because you've read.
I know.
Ellen G. writes, so as I reread this chapter, quote, do no harm, unquote, stood out to me, and I tried to read it through slowly to determine if Raymond is indeed a traveler like Claire. They discuss the various ways that a lost maidenhead is restored, and we learn Fergus has told Claire about the women he was with, meaning the ones he kind of grew up with, not the actual women he was with. Brown, chingy, brown, brown. So the ways of restoring virginity. She mentions a shoat's bladder. I looked it up. I did not have a clue. That's a young pig, by the way. A young pig's bladder full of chicken blood. You can only imagine how all that goes down or comes out. He brings out Saracen's consound for the healing of wounds. Chelidonium for inducing sleep. And we learn that Raymond had learned of the poppy incident. The poppy syrup or juice or whatever that was.
Of course he did, because gossip is rife in Paris.
Of course. After hearing one of the far-fetched versions of what he had learned from gossip, she offers to tell him what actually happened. He replies, quote, the truth is always of use, Madonna. It has the value of rarity, you know. Now, I did not capitalize the word Madonna in this context when I wrote this quote, when I typed this quote up.
Because he didn't but capitalize
hold on,
it.
Exactly. I did not capitalize it, but thank you, Microsoft Word, for doing so.
Can we also talk about Madonna and Like a Virgin and this whole conversation? They're totally not related.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
They're totally yes. not related in the Gabaldon
Except
universe.
That she's not like a virgin.
I'm just saying.
So, in his private room, under the belly scoot, drinking his cherry brandy, she tells him the truth. About Mary, she says all she can do is help Mary try to heal. Master Raymond catches this wording and points out a difference in her words to what others would say. Most physicians, he says, would say, quote, I will try to heal her, rather than help her to heal. He says he thought she would be able to perceive the difference. There's not much one can do for someone who has been raped, she says, at least not physically. Raymond says, perhaps not. But if anyone is capable of reaching the patient's center, surely it would be La Dame Blanche. Ellen writes, the patient's center? So someone else is catching things up too. She's surprised by his statement, but more struck on the first part, the patient's center. He does a demonstration of the effect of dragon's blood in a silver-lined goblet. All healing is done essentially by reaching the soul, the essence, by reaching the patient's center, from which they can heal themselves. Surely you have seen it, Madonna. La Dame Blanche sees the essence of a man and turns it to healing or to death, so an evildoer may well fear to look upon her face.
I mean, that was made quite clear on a Paris street not too long ago.
The night before?
Yeah. That's my point.
Ellen writes, and then the dragon blood incident. As if he didn't want to answer her question, but then he does. Very holistic way of healing for that time, eh? Healing from the inside, from the soul level, and outwards. Very 21st century Europe. So Jamie had been the inspiration, or he'd begun the tale at least, but Raymond had furthered it. The tale that Claire was La Dame Blanche. As an authority on supernatural stuff, of course, he says, she has been seen in his shop. Her background is a mystery. His reputation is suspect. He moves in circles where a speculation as to her true identity may be taken with undue seriousness. And he says, and you know how people talk. She then mentions her other concern, Charles Stewart.
Raymond.
Dude, she does more than mention her concern with Charles Stewart.
She goes straight up.
She's just like, direct. She's like, takes a deep breath and goes,
boom.
Is he planning to invade Scotland and take his throne back? Like, there's no like preamble. No. There's like, no like she doesn't testing have time. The waters. The sun's going she's down. Like,
no.
She all right, has to you get and to I, Mary's. You and I are like, we're good. So I'm just gonna put this out there for you.
Raymond admits he has heard something small. One of Charles' agents made inquiries in Holland. Someone named O'Brien had wanted to open negotiations for a shipment of 2,000 broadswords purchased in Spain and sent through Holland to conceal their origin. He said it could be that the King of Spain was maybe willing to help Charles, but maybe not openly. He mentions that King Louis also entertains an English duke, whom we know as Sandringham, and that the duke is there to seek some arrangements of trade. They discuss briefly the possibility that Louis was negotiating with England for support of his invasion of Brussels, maybe? Ellen writes, then Claire gets the goods on Charles Stewart and what he is doing, and Raymond tells her a lot, and at the same time is playing with Quicksilver or Mercury. I love how Diana uses the Mercury to symbolize the nature of their story and the discussion. They come apart, the droplets, and return together, and when they return, they are one. It just seems so interesting given the time travel, etc., even though that's not what they're talking about. And then how he hits the table and the fragments scattered again in different directions. What did you think about the Mercury and a secondary storyline right there? Very symbolic.
It was a lot going on at once for me.
Yeah, it was.
Like, because the symbology of it and the reality of it and all of those things. And then I think about Mercury today where people are like, Mercury poisoning, don't touch it. And his concern was, it's going to ruin your rings. And I'm thinking, you could die. So, like, I had all of these, like, thought processes going through my head when he was playing with that Mercury that were distracting to me. So I had a hard time quieting my inner brain on that.
Your inner brain as opposed to your outer brain?
Don't judge me.
Regarding the Comte, he had only heard that Charles visited his new partner at the docks and looks at the ships. Before she leaves, Raymond gets her attention and warns her not to touch a drop of the Mercury. It bonds with any metal it touches. So it makes me think, why that little line there? Because well, she wasn't doing it on purpose. She was about to try and not have it fall.
But if he is a TT, a time traveler,
yes,
he clearly is not as advanced as Claire, or more advanced than she is, because if they were from perhaps somewhere around our time period, they would know that Mercury causes more damage than just to your rings. It's a
that is true
cause poisoning in human
that
beings.
That is true. But if he were a time traveler and he had been forward and back and sideways and whatever, and he knew this modern and he had modern knowledge, what we consider modern knowledge of Mercury, he would have, in the 18th century, not used language or not said certain things that would have not
given
been
him away.
Not been under, well, not given him away. He could have definitely said things, not facts about the future, but properties of a metal. That's, I think, safe enough to say, but he could have used safer language. Like, he wouldn't use modern terminologies.
I don't disagree with that statement. I think he's a smart person. I think that if he is, and it's been discussed at length by numerous individuals, including Diana herself, that he is potentially a time traveler himself. So I think that him not knowing that Claire is a time traveler would probably push him to perhaps dissuade her from interacting with the Mercury in whatever fashion he thought might get her to stop immediately, which if she was of that time period, don't ruin your pretty rings. Which I guess that makes sense. So I guess I've talked myself in and out of that all on my own.
She makes a joke about not getting burnt as a witch at the Place de la Bastille. Only slightly joking, remembering, as ever, Cranesmuir.
Dude.
Which is what, Summer? Tell us. Tell listeners again.
The Witch Trials?
Yes,
Witch
but
Trials.
What is that to me?
Oh, your favorite scene in the first novel?
Get the word right. Sequence.
Oh, sequence.
It's not a chapter. It's not a scene.
And regarding her being possibly burned as a witch, Raymond says with complete seriousness, certainly not. No one's been burned for witchcraft in Paris in 20 years at least.
They're delightfully pro superstition in Paris, apparently.
So it seems like she's safe as long as she doesn't kill anyone. On the way to Mary's, she thinks of the Comte. He is placed in the center of the mysterious circles that Raymond referred to. As she approaches Mary's house and she's with Fergus, it seems the house is basically battened down, Diana writes, against the coming of disaster. Actually, disaster already made its way in, so you're not really keeping anything else out.
I can see how it makes you feel more self-protective, and so you want to keep more out.
It's all symbolic. It's like they're barring the windows, they're barring the doors in an effort to try to do the thing that they're. Is it stopping the gossip? No. Is it stopping everyone saying what happened? No, but it makes them feel like they're doing something, and there's literally nothing they can do. But it's
also the same thing that they're expected to do
by society. It's true. But there's literally nothing they can do at this point to make it any better. It just makes them feel like they're doing something.
They're protecting themselves,
and to a degree, Mary, even though it's not really helping her.
So there is kind of a, I wouldn't say kerfuffle, but let's just say they don't have the easiest, it's not violent or brutal in any way, but they don't have the easiest access to the front door and to getting in. So she ends up relying on Fergus, but they do make their way in after a little chat.
How old is he?
I think he's like 10.
They end up relying on a 10-year-old.
9 or 10.
Like, what does that say? Like, I can't come up with any better solution than to let this 10-year-old step in and make everything work out.
What was the line or the word? Was it havers? What was the line or the word that Fergus says in English? In English.
Havers. He says havers woman.
And what is havers woman?
He says, I will read you the entire line. He says, "Haverswoman," said Fergus in his best Scots accent. He viewed this spectacle of derangement disapprovingly. The maid says the young mistress is upstairs in her room.
But what is havers?
I mean, I can Google it.
So can I.
As effectively as you can, but I'm imagining he's just like, stop talking nonsense. I know where she is. Let's just get to the bottom of this. I know what havering is.
Hold on. To hem and haw. Well, I'm reading the IPA. It says, received pronunciation, which would be the British, right? Or the English. There you go.
When Hava. I hear that, think of I Will Walk 500 Miles by the Proclaimers.
Hava?
Yeah. And when I haver, I know I'm going to be.
Got it.
I'm
gonna be that was okay, that's not the best, but that's my best. Following the IPA, it says here, and the Wiktionary, pronunciation, received pronunciation, IPA key, haver, and Scotland IPA, haver, hyphenation, rhymes, I don't need to go there. Anyway.
Oh my God, is that in the UK, public forum yet? Can we post that I Will Walk 500 Miles as an example?
No, it's not quite yet.
Dang it!
So UK to hem and haw, Scotland, usually haver, to maunder, to talk foolishly, to chatter, talking nonsense, to babble. So there we go, all of that. So basically nonsense.
I'll take it.
Me too. So Ellen writes, Fergus speaking in a Scottish accent. Can't wait to see and hear that. Especially a wee 10-year-old French Fergus.
But it won't be a Scottish accent. It will be a French Scottish accent. His best Scottish accent. Which would be haver.
Who knows?
I mean, how do you roll and R all at the same time?
He may not have the end R done right. He may not have the final R, the roll.
Mm.
But even if he does haver,
it'll be cute.
Starting at Scotch, Scotch,
Scotch.
Ooh, starting at Scottish and ending at French is that's hard to do even in my mind. Once they get in, she goes to Mary's room. The room she enters is like a cave, Diana writes. Drapes pulled shut. Smoke is in the room from the fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just not getting out. Mary was basically playing possum until Claire is alone in the room with her and her aunt is no longer there. She tells Mary about the herbs she brought and says that Mary won't get pregnant because the man wasn't able to finish. And I wrote, what? And of course, Claire to herself in her own inner dialogue is saying, I hope not, probably not. And then it kind of made her sick to think of this one thing. And then she thought, she thought if she were pregnant, it could be Frank's ancestor.
So can we talk about this for a second? She says it could be Frank's ancestor, but Blackjack Randall and Alex Randall look so much like Frank that there's no other possibility as to who Frank's ancestor could be. If it was just Mary Hawkins, Mary Hawkins doesn't look like Frank. So there's no way that a Randall boy could not have fathered the ancestor of Frank, period.
And since we know Mary Hawkins is not a Randall girl or boy.
Correct.
And so they need the Randall gamete in some way.
Gamete.
Hey,
I know. Sex cell. I was so afraid where you were going to go with that.
What could I possibly say starting with G?
No, you paused a little bit before gamete. So I was like, we need the Randall what?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know what else.
You can edit that out. It's cool.
No, I'm happy with it. I just don't understand it. Claire opens the drapes and the windows. Mary talks a bit and, of course, ends up crying over Alex.
Aww. Poor lamb. Wee lamb.
Claire says that she will see Alex again, and she is thinking on his love for Mary. She thinks of the possibilities of what has been lost with Alex and feels very bad for Mary, and as she's comforting her, she weeps herself.
Well, the whole thing of that is that not only what saddened me about it is that it almost didn't matter her state. She was never going to be able to marry Alex anyway. Well, because of his status, because of her status and his status, she, regardless of her rape, would never have been able to marry him. They were never on the same social status. They would never have been able to be together, honestly. So, I mean, she was destined to be sad about it no matter what. That's kind of what I took away from that. I've also read all of the books, so I've got a lot more going on in my head right now.
When she leaves, she has a letter written by Mary and witnessed with a statement of the events of the night before. And this should take care of any trouble they would be having still with the law.
Should.
At this point, yes, I can't say anything else, so don't say that.
No, I would say should. That's all I got.
As she enters their home, she sees all sorts of notes and nosegays, but ignores them. On the way up the stairs, she begins to take her layers of clothing off. Jamie was lying in a chair, his hair, quote, sticking up in all directions, sure sign of mental turmoil at some point. He smiles at her and says, "It's all right, you're home." And Diana ends the chapter beautifully. Then we were silent as we undressed each other and went finally to earth, each finding delayed and wordless sanctuary in the other's embrace.
Which is a super classy way of saying they totally did it.
But I love it when it said, and went finally to earth.
You know, it was funny. I was reading this chapter earlier today, and when I finished it, I was like, oh, that was so, like, that was such a nice picturesque way to end the chapter. And that was, you know, my mature side. And then I thought back, and I was like, you know, I read a lot of, like...
Your mature side? Wait, what?
Wait for it. Let me finish.
Okay.
I read a lot of, like, John Jakes and, like, other, like, historical fiction novels when I was younger, like, when I was at Grandma's house or something like that. She had books. Anyway, let me finish.
I miss my statement, Grandma.
And at the time, because, you know, I, like, cut my teeth on, like, Harlequin historicals and, like, inappropriate novels for young children. But I remember feeling cheated that it was, like, all that fade to firelight nonsense. Whenever they'd get, like, you'd think you were going to get a graphic scene with two people being, like, intimate together. And it would be, like, the fade to firelight. And I'd be like, oh, this totally reminded me of, like, reading John Jakes and other like, authors like that when I was younger. Because I was like, ugh, you just cheated me out of whatever awesome thing was going to happen in that scene. But I also thought when I read it tonight, I was like, oh, that was really beautiful. And I was like, oh, my God, I've, like, matured and grown. And I'm upset about that.
I understand.
Kind of upset about that. I missed that part of me that was like, this isn't graphic enough. I thought it was poignant and beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Anyway,
I've matured and I'm sad about it. And apparently that is chapter 20. I'm not going to promise we're going to do chapter 21 next week because we don't know what? So much going on. At some point, we will rejoin our read-along. And at that point, we will be discussing chapter 21 entitled Untimely Resurrection. And I think we'll have a guest in studio with us to discuss this chapter.
Can I say who?
You can.
Well, we know who. It's our horsey friend, a horsey expert.
Who's that? Lene. Yeah, that's right. So, when we do get back to our read-alongs and we discuss chapter 21, we will be joined by Miss Lene. We haven't had her on for a while. She's been a little busy with stuff.
So thank you, as always, so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.